Welcome, everybody. This is the last session in the Earth Science Ontolog miniseries. Today is December 12, 2012. And this final session is on moving forward with semantics for Earth Science data. We have a talk on building blocks for EarthCube, and then tutorials on ontologies and GeoSparkle. And at the end, we have a summary of the series as a whole and some discussion about next steps. Okay, so on slide three, Krishna Sinha is starting to talk with the building blocks for EarthCube. Then I will give a short transition talk looking at one of the architecture diagrams for EarthCube. Leo Oberst will talk about ontologies. Dave Colas will talk on GeoSparkle. And then Krishna and Leo will do a wrap-up, and we're asking everyone to hold their questions until the end. And for the speakers, just to remember to give the slide number as they advance. So with that, Krishna could start with his talk on building blocks for EarthCube.
Thanks. Okay, what I thought I would do to explore some of the challenges of EarthCube is basically try and advance the notion that EarthCube is made up of multiple challenges that you can think of as an overarching architecture which needs to be designed to meet these challenges. Okay, so basically the slide number one is to make the point from a science perspective that what EarthCube is attempting to do is to develop the capabilities that provide the science community an integrated view of the Earth as a system of systems, which I believe, and I firmly believe, is the real driver of the success of EarthCube. And I've identified the five major systems that comprise the geosciences, the hydrosphere, geosphere, biosphere, atmosphere, and the anthrosphere. So within these systems that I choose to call as data environment, where scientists generate data, we need to be able to access, share, and integrate across systems. And I also make a point in the first slide that the use cases should reflect data heterogeneity associated with these multiple systems, and we should know that the data are globally distributed. It's a very important, significant challenge. So slide number two is really the layout of the major challenges faced EarthCube as an enterprise. Clearly, data publication and access, diversity of data, interoperability, trust, preservation and sustainability. All of these are major issues, and I'm trying to make a case that an infrastructure must address all of these through social engineering and science-oriented research and development to make EarthCube successful. A bit of an explanation of these terms. This is adopted from Riding the Wave and the National Science Foundation vision of EarthCube. And I've highlighted in red some key terms that we have to address as we move towards using EarthCube to solve geoscience challenges, scientific challenges. So if you can remember these red terms, I'm going to capture them differently and show it to you in this diagram on figure four, where I specifically mention that to meet each one of these challenges, we need a systems approach to building an infrastructure. And within these challenges, for example, finding data beyond keyword search is important if we want citizens to use the data who are not very familiar with all the technical words. So this infrastructure must utilize social, scientific, and engineering research methods. Slide number 5 is the same diagram, but here in red, I show the clear impact of what semantics can do to meet many of these challenges. The ones in sort of black, for example, if you look down towards the bottom of the slide, where it says what and whom to trust, or ownership of data, we have to come up with some very innovative semantic technologies to help those kinds of challenges. So slide 6, as far as I can tell, I recognize 3 very distinct infrastructures. The social infrastructure, the engineering, and the science infrastructures, all working together through a governance equals communication mechanism, which is required to meet the development of the building blocks that I've shown you in earlier slides. For example, the social infrastructure, in my perspective, is dominated by communication, governance, education, and trust. So these are the highlights of what I believe research and funding has to come through to develop these capabilities within the social infrastructure. So if we move to the next infrastructure, which is slide number 8, this is the engineering infrastructure. And this has been taken from the layered architecture roadmap available on the EarthCube website. But I've basically broken it down. There's a layered architecture component, there's brokering, there's workflows, there's web services, data grid, LOD, web or semantic web, and ontology. So these are the engineering things that are required for developing the engineering infrastructure. The science infrastructure, as captured in slide number 9, is very strongly dominated by semantics, vocabulary, the meaning of data. So here we have to develop semantics, utilize that to make our presence be known on the semantic web, develop vocabularies, metadata, quality challenges, how to assess quality, the different environments, the 5 environments that I started off at slide number 1, and ways to share data. And here I want to basically identify 2 important things from a science perspective. There are data that are very well planned, curated, highly visible. These are generally sensor-based data. There are large volumes of it, and they generally reside in data centers. But the long tail of science, individuals, our data is very poorly curated, and it's hardly visible. The data are often unstructured, heterogeneous, small volumes are involved. And our control vocabulary ranges into tens of thousands of terms. So slide number 9 is followed by an image, an understanding of how we can link these two data environments. The one on the top from the data centers are very homogeneous, simple vocabulary and terms can access it. The one on the bottom, the long tail of science data, like I said earlier, very unstructured, heterogeneous, small volume. And I think if we approach access to these data through the semantic web environment by providing capabilities to scientists like myself to share our data in the linked open data system environment, then we have an opportunity to develop new capabilities to integrate data coming out of data centers and those coming out of individuals. Slide 11 is simply a recap of what I have said, and I have always used the phrase that we want to go from data to knowledge. So our data are associated with the five realms, geosphere, biosphere, atmosphere, and subclasses of these realms. The data providers are individuals, agencies, government, and industry. Types of data, text, graphics, numerical, models, sensors, terms. And I highlight metadata in the middle, and I'll take a second to explain why that's important to us in science. And then services like visualization, computational, process, modeling capabilities are all within what we would like to share and have access to it. And where do these things reside? Which I call as data pools. They reside in data centers, libraries, journals, etc. And we tend to discover them through keyword-based searches. And I would argue we need to go beyond that to something else. And finally, the knowledge is when we start deploying capabilities of how and why certain things happen in nature. And I think that is also the key to curiosity-based education. Slide 12 is what I look at as an assembly of building blocks for the Earth Cube infrastructure, from data and its environment, from sharing, including trust and reward system, to location, where does it reside, how do we discover it, and access, it could be controlled, access to data centers or slightly more open in a semantic web environment, and the discovery based on keywords, or what I have been writing about is data ontologies, workflows, and brokering. So these are the building blocks of EarthCube. And this is a slide that I believe many of my colleagues have participated in putting it together. And the things in green at the bottom are all these semantically based capabilities that we should be thinking of deploying to help build an infrastructure for the geosciences. You'll have plenty of time to examine it, but basically I'm emphasizing that the semantic infrastructure must include registration technologies, ontology development, ontology-based services, ontology-based discovery services, integration services, and finally, knowledge services. All of these are semantically enhanced capabilities. And so in summary, I'd say infrastructures that we wish to develop for EarthCube, whether it's social engineering or science infrastructures, they have to be coordinated through different stages. it's unlikely we can do it all in one fell swoop. It's going to evolve over time. And I am a great believer that individual scientists, their right to data should be protected. We have to have developed the protocols to do that. I also would encourage us to think that use cases should reflect social, cultural, and scientific environments. And semantic capabilities for discovery should go beyond vocabulary to what I call as data level ontologies, where we can tag the measured unit itself, the measurements themselves, rather than depend on the community to know each other's vocabulary. And I end up by saying EarthQ will be a huge success through changes that it can bring about in the social infrastructure first. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Krishna. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. So that was a great overview of the scope of what the components are of EarthCube and how important the semantic components are. So I'm just going to give a few transition slides to go between this talk and Leo's talk. Are my slides up?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, this is Nancy. I'm Nancy Wiegand from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And slide two, as I just mentioned this already, I'm going to transition between the ontology tutorial and the GeoSparkle tutorial. So slide three, I guess it says, I have the slide numbers mixed up. So the next slide is, it actually shows a picture of the different EarthCube communities. And there are many of them, as you can read on the left-hand side. The Semantics and Ontologies group is the one on the right, but we also feel that the Semantics and Ontologies work actually goes across all of the different community groups of EarthCube. So the next slide, which might be called slide three, okay, so this is from the Ning site as a description of the Semantics and Ontology Community Group, that we are interested in developing and using ontologies regarding standards, standardizing terms, supporting the use of standards, resolve heterogeneous terms across domains or subdomains, and working with metadata and provenance. So now slide five. This just gives a really simple overview of a need for semantic interoperability. Just a simple example. Suppose that a user is interested in records that have to do with rivers, and as you can see, the three databases of those, none of them contain the term river, but yet they contain records that would be relevant. So without ontologies as a background, or at least synonyms, but you actually need more than synonyms, because watershed wouldn't be a synonym, it would be sort of like a containment, there'd be a part of containment relationship. So without any background information, there would be no results from that query. So the idea is to have background information available. Okay, so the next slide is slide six. Now this architecture picture, I thought was the latest architecture, and then I found out that there's a subsequent one. But this one is actually better to speak to anyway. So there are the main EarthCube is in the center. It's a box. But as I understand it, it's not the design that there's a central controlling EarthCube portal. An EarthCube portal might just be on a side, and the different domains would actually be communicating directly with each other. So the upper left is basically a web portal infrastructure. The bottom right is a high-performance computing infrastructure. And on the left, you have linked open data. So what I circled circled in red were all the components that had to do with semantics. If you go to next slide, slide 7, ontologies are mentioned in the link to Open Data Cloud, and ontologies, as Leo will explain, describe a domain as to concepts and terms and relationships, and he will explain that further. So in slide 8, we have a terms for semantics that are just, it seems to be they're just given as placeholders in the upper left and lower right clouds. So there would be much more involved there. That's, they haven't, people haven't worked out the architecture yet regarding the semantic components. So on slide 9, you have the box in the middle that mentions the semantic mappings, where you would actually have, could have, stored mapping files that show how terms in one data set or one domain compare to terms in another data set or domain. And then finally in slide 10, I thought this was interesting that this architecture picture gives an entire cloud for linked open data, because currently most data would be in relational database systems or in Excel spreadsheets or just in, you know, ordinary files. But this architecture diagram is recognizing that, at least in the future, much of the data could be in linked format, you know, in RDF. And so this cloud does show that you would have ontologies, you'd have reasoners, you'd have triple stores, and that this will be a component of data that will need to be handled in EarthCube. So with that, I would like to transition into Leo's talk on semantic technology, focusing on ontologies and OWL2. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. This is Leo. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, I'm going to talk. The focus is on ontologies within semantic technology. So I want to position ontologies with respect to other models that we consider within that spectrum of technologies. Slide 2. We face in our information technology these days a real crisis, because we have increasingly complex systems, data and infrastructure. Really, for us to go the next step, we need to bring our information technology up to human level interaction, which means that we really need more semantics, explicit semantics. We need to go from the machine level to the human level, make sure the machine comes up to us as opposed to we go down to the machine. So we need to go really from data and information levels to knowledge levels, more structured data and more semantic. Semantics for that data. Semantic integration also, which is very crucial, requires semantic technology. So we need representation of semantics, and then we need integration of that semantics. Next slide. So there's a premise here and a promise, and we think that semantic technologies can enrich a number of applications. You can think of initially search, discovery, navigation, because that's how we get at our data. So it applies initially to data integration. That's typically the first application for semantic technology. You have databases or data sources. They're in silos, they're heterogeneous, you need to bring them together. But once you have that, and that includes unstructured data, of course, what you have to do is apply other technology such as information extraction, natural language technology to assist you. But then the applications can range from social networking, intelligence, analytics, business intelligence, situational awareness. All these are mostly decision support, in some sense, applications. But they're based on semantic data integration initially. So there's many emerging tools, existing models, emerging models, and patterns. The application of semantic technologies to these areas, search, discovery, navigation, really by adding semantics to the data, provides, of course, finer grain search, more increased precision, richer results, discovery of complex social and information relationships, and, of course, entity disambiguation correlation, the who, the what, the why, the how, the when. Now, the issue is that humans have complex semantics that we can't really duplicate in the machines. All we can do is approximate. So we're never going to have the level of fidelity, granularity, context of usage that humans have until the machines are probably nearly human. But in the meantime, the machines can really assist us at our level by employing semantic technologies. Next slide is the ontology spectrum. Many people have seen this before, but I use this as an educational device. The focus we're interested in is logical theories, what I call strong ontologies, the upper right. That whole spectrum, if you look at from the bottom left to the upper right, it ranges from what we call weak or weakly represented, less rich semantics, lower left, and then upper right is the strong semantics, richer semantics. It's because the languages that you can express things in are richer, which means the content can be richer. There's more, you can express more semantics and make things more precise. You can address consistency issues in your data much more than you can at the lower left level. And then, of course, those way stations are in black font, taxonomy, thesaurus, conceptual model, and logical theory. These are all what we call semantic models. They're just ranging in expressivity. So a taxonomy, if it's a strong one, is really the core of an ontology. It's a subclass of the backbone of the ontology. You have weaker ones, too, of course. And you have thesauri. Think of WordNet as a quasi-thesaurus. Nowadays, it would probably be represented in SCOTS or SCOTS, as you pronounce it. People pronounce it differently, which is basically a vocabulary defined, standard defined by the W3C for vocabularies and structured vocabularies like thesauri. Conceptual models, of course, UML, we know from the object-oriented community, it's expressive. The main thing is there's really not a logic yet behind it, which is the distinction between it and a strong ontology, a logical theory, where, in fact, you have a logic basis for the language. So we're focusing mostly on OWL in this briefing, but people should understand that there's other languages, and more will be emerging, such as Common Logic. Next slide. Again, very simple definition of ontology. Defines the terms used to describe and represent an area of knowledge. And by the way, this is slide 5. You can think of that area of knowledge as a domain or just a subject area. it really then is both the formal vocabulary and the meaning of that. But in addition, it means that the machine can use it. So it's if you will, it's a model, meaning it's a machine usable representation. And of course, for the high-end ontologies, the logical theories, there's a logic behind it, which means the machine, let's say an inference engine or another kind of application that understands the logic that the ontology is expressed in, can make inferences that are comparable to what a human would make. And of course, we're interested in many, many domains. We want to share information among us humans, but also at a certain point among machines. So we do really want to have machine-to-machine communication of semantics as known by humans. And of course, we need to have that machine-represented knowledge to do that. Next slide, slide 6. We make a distinction between term and concept. So if you think of vocabulary versus ontology, you have a term versus a concept. Term is a word or phrase in natural language, for example. It could be simple in a dictionary. Data dictionaries are probably just English describing some data element, and a human has to read it. But it could also be a term that's expressed in a structured vocabulary, such as a thesaurus. These are lexical resources. So you think of that as a weak lexical semantics that really requires, if you want to have machine interpretation and strong semantic technology, you need concepts, what those terms mean, and represented in an ontology. So we have a graph here in the middle, which is a snippet of a thesaurus, where an automobile is narrower than a vehicle, and we also have it car synonymous with an automobile. We quote these because realistically they're rather more like strings. We don't know what the meanings of those things are. We just know this simple subsumption called narrower than, or supersumption called broader than. But they can point to nodes, which we call concepts in an ontology, that provide the meaning, the relationships, the subclassing, in a strong taxonomic backbone, the properties and values associated with what these things actually mean. Both are necessary. Terminology and ontology. Next slide is 7. When you have these models, another way to look at these semantic models and the range of models is, as you increase in the expressiveness of your model, more complex applications become realizable. So with a taxonomy, of course, we can put buckets of documents in some sort of structured hierarchy, and we use that for simple indexing and categorization, navigation. With a thesaurus, you can expand a search, for example, free text search. Using query expansion, going to a thesaurus with the terms you enter, finding the synonyms. If you're searching for a helmet, you might find a head protector. You might find other things that are synonymous with that, which increases your recall, meaning you get more of what is really relevant returned to you. And of course, if you want to zoom in on that, get an increased precision, you probably need richer on the way towards kind of semantic search, or at least question answering, where you may want an answer as opposed to a set of documents. Even if they're a small set of documents, you really want one answer. Think of Watson in the Jeopardy contest, the automated system IBM used. It was a question-answering system. It had a lot of power, but it also included semantic technologies. And the point is that you want to come up with one right answer. With a logical theory, of course, even more is possible, because now you can have, in fact, machine-to-machine interpretation in addition to human-to-machine. And, of course, much more automated reasoning and complex semantic web services are possible. Next slide is 8. Semantic web. We're going to zoom in a little bit on just OWL. So the primary web today, if you will, since its inception, has been focused on really links and resources, syntactic mostly, and really focused on presentation of human documents. So HTML, for example, now has given rise some to XML, which is a way of structuring your data and presenting it, but without really much semantics. So today's Google predominantly is free text-based. It finds string correlations and tries to provide, based upon the strings you enter, the words in your query, it tries to provide approximate best answers or ranked according to some relevance ranking, which is a complex algorithm, that kind of bootstraps from statistical models to give you approximately what they think you mean. But there's also emerging semantic web, which is really focusing more on machines at least doing partially the interpretation of what humans mean. So humans having to do less work because the machines approximate and assist the human. And an example of that, of course, is like a Google Knowledge Graph, which at least is including some semantic technology to be more precise. There's other efforts, of course. We know about schema.org, where if you use even a simple vocabulary, not a complex semantic, complex ontology yet, it still will assist you in your search. Next slide is just that an old kind of view. We had a lot of layer cake pictures of the semantic web early on, and this is mostly still accurate. Basically, the whole notion was a stack view where the things on top really use the things on the bottom. So as you went up, it's really kind of an extension from the lower level things to the higher level things, with more and more semantics coming into play. Exposing your data at the RDF schema level, adding more complex ontology at the OWL level, and of course above that, enabling reasoning and querying proof rule reasoning. So initially the semantic web rule language, now kind of being superseded by RIF, the rule interchange format language. First order logic is out there. It's not yet a tool, except insofar as common logic is a tool that could be used, but there's really not so many applications yet that provide support for common logic. And inference. And of course, Sparkle, which we really won't go into, but Dave will a little bit in the following talk. And of course, all through this is security and trust, which is, if you recall in Krishna's initial slides, is a very important part of community. Next slide is slide 10. OWL2, just a very quick recapitulation of some of the things that OWL2 provides. You may recall that AL1 was a standard or recommendation as of 2004, and in a sense it built on DAML and DAML plus OIL initially, and description logic research within AI that spanned maybe close to 20 years. AL2 enables you to have other things that we found might be necessary or important if you really want to make AL usable in a greater fashion. So increased data type coverage, but also syntactic sugar. In the next slide, we'll show you a few of these new constructs, ways of shortening what you have to do in order to provide the capability for modeling within AL. Some new constructs that really go beyond the expressivity of the initial AL. Simple meta-modeling capabilities and really extended annotation capabilities, and then what we call profiles. So the next slide is 11. So we always found it extremely important to make sure that when you create AL models that you, in many cases you want to let your model and the reasoner that will use your model and of course the users know that your classes are disjoint, that they can't be construed as a member or an individual within the same class. Class A couldn't be construed as potentially a member or an individual in class B if they were made disjoint. Well, there's some new constructs which really are syntactic sugar in AL2 that enables you to do it more easily. Things such as disjoint union, disjoint classes, and additional things like in many cases you would like to do, for example, property chaining. The old example was trying to define uncle in terms of maybe brother and father. You may have two properties that you really want to chain together to define uncle. And so that's actually made much more easily, more easier done within AL2. There's other things you may want to do. For example, you may want to have a notion of of class that is kind of close to a property. In many cases in your modeling, you may have requirements that go really beyond AL1, and so AL2 provides some of those. Next slide is slide 12. Even AL1 had a form of meta-modeling, but it only really occurred at AL4. In other words, you could interpret an instance as being a class simultaneously. Which was really not exactly what you wanted in all cases, and AL4 had perhaps some formal properties that you didn't like undecidability. So AL2 now provides a little more of that capability and meta-modeling capability. Punning, which again means that you're using different uses of the same term and the individual, but there's still restrictions. So AL2 DL, which stands for description logic, still has certain restrictions. You can't use a name for both a class and a data type. Semantically, the names are really distinct for reasoners. You can't really smush together your what amounts to having two universes of discourse here. Annotations, many more annotation assertions possible for ontologies. And new constructs that really increase the expressivity. So declarations of various kinds that you can make now on an entity or a portion of the ontology. Next slide, slide 13, profiles. Really, Al Fool had, beyond Al Light, two major dialects, Al Description Logic and Al Fool. But experience with Al 1 showed that there were many kinds of applications of using Al. You may have large-scale applications that you get, for example, in the medical and life sciences that really are huge ontologies, and there are many cases they're making the bridge from terminologies to ontologies. So you'd like to have a specific profile addressing a large-scale ontology application. Others are focused on databases where you may have a lot of data directly in your relational database, and so your focus is really on querying. And then other applications where you might want to have rule reasoning more closely combined with your ontology. What it amounted to is that three additional profiles, you can think of these as sub-languages, if you will, have been defined. In the interest of time, we're on the next slide, 14. I just wanted to give you a couple pictures of what some of the components of an OWL ontology, mostly expressed in OWL 2. Using Protégé 4.1, which is really only OWL-based. The earlier version, which is actually a coincident, simultaneous, version 3.4, supported OWL, but also supported another paradigm, the original paradigm, which is more like a frame-based language that Protégé began with. But Protégé 4.1 is focused on OWL and the related constructs and languages, RDF and Sparkle, for example. And this is the usual pizza ontology. This is not earth science here, except that we grow the food and, of course, make the pizzas and eat them. But it shows that some local property restrictions, for example, established on vegetarian pizza here, that tries to constrain what the classes, what the instances of vegetarian pizza can be. Think of property, local property restrictions as axioms, if you will. It's not full first-order logic axioms, but they are logical axioms you can associate with classes. And in some cases, what we call a property restriction really is more like a local rather than a global domain and range constraint on a property. It's more localized to specific classes. The next slide, slide 15, is we're just looking at the named pizzas here. So, for example, the focus is on this Caprina, which is described as having really only a certain range of toppings available. And so you have that facility for modeling much more precisely than you perhaps you've seen in previous examples of ontologies. The next slide, slide 16, is use of a reasoner in your ontology. So, for example, in Protégé 4.1, there's a number of reasoners you can use. I was using Hermit 1.3.4 here to go from really the asserted model to the inferred model. So what a reasoner does, basically a description logic reasoner, is it tries to reason about the model you've given it and actually generate the potential inferred model based upon the constraints you've placed on the ontology. If you don't do it right, of course, people in an instance like John Smith could be construed to be some kind of pepperoni pizza. That's the old anecdote is that if you don't rule things out, they could be ruled in, and a reasoner may find anomalies like that that exist, put it in the same model, and then make an equivalence assertion between the two instances. So if you don't constrain your ontology to express to the machine exactly what you mean, it could be misconstrued. So what the inferred model does here is provide the range of interpretations, in a sense, for what your base model states. So after the reasoning, the inferred model is displayed on the right side, and it shows that it's been inferred that caprina is a type of vegetarian pizza, but also it's a type of the equivalence assertion, equivalence classes describing vegetarian pizza 1 and vegetarian pizza 2. So what it did was infer the taxonomic backbone of the ontology, so it put all the assertions and the instances in the inferred model as you constrained the model to be. Which is useful. It's not yet rule reasoning, but again, it's very powerful for the use of ontologies. Slide 17. Just a kind of view of the tools available to some extent for semantic web technologies. So everything from ontology and development environments, such as Protégé, TopRaid, and others, to query tools, nowadays mostly using Sparkle, to searches, semantic search engines and use of semantic search, programmatic interfaces, so you can call semantic web, let's say, in Java or some other languages using an OWL API to deal with OWL and RDF. Vocabulary to ontology linkages, ontology mapping, triple stores. There's a whole range of technologies and tools that are now available, including, of course, ontology repositories, one of the example of which is the Open Ontology Repository that Ontolog itself is working on. The next slide, slide 18. Back in 2009, when people analyzed the open web and the number of triples that were available, it was estimated there were 4.7 billion RDF triples. In September 2010, there were 13 billion triples. So what this picture is trying to depict here is the range of data sources expressed in triples and their relationships between each other. And so over on the right is kind of the key, describing the size of the circles and the thickness of the arrows in terms of the number of linkages or relationships between these sources. The next slide shows the progress even more. So this is actually September 2011, so that's a mistake. It should be 2011, but now 31.5 billion triples. So it's an ever-expanding cloud. And finally, the last slide, 20, is it's just going to grow. For big systems, big data, the future means that you're going to have millions and billions and trillions of semantic interactions. And, of course, things that we haven't addressed in this yet, in this briefing, RIF and Sparkle, for lack of space, Sparkle will be addressed a little bit by David, and more is coming, Common Logic. So thank you, folks, and I'll turn it over to Nancy.
Okay, Leo, thank you very much for a great talk. So the next talk is by Dave Colas talking about GeoSparkle.
Hi there. So I'm Dave Colas, and I'll be talking about GeoSparkle. We're going to go sort of more into the details with this talk, and I'm going to show some RDF and Sparkle examples, and hopefully those of you who are familiar with these things already will be able to keep right up along, and if you're not, then hopefully you will be able to go and take a look at those things and cross-reference and make this presentation useful to you. So on to slide 2. What I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to give you an introduction to GeoSparkle. I'm going to talk about the two main parts of GeoSparkle, the GeoSparkle vocabulary and the query relations. And then we're going to walk through a very, very simple worked example, including a domain ontology, some instance data that adheres to that domain ontology, and a very simple query. And then I'll wrap up. On to slide 3. Why do we need GeoSparkle? Well, if you believe Leo and all of and Nancy and everyone else who thinks that semantics are very useful for earth sciences and geospatial domains in general and the web in general, well, then you know that semantics can be useful for data integration problems, for problems that involve reasoning, etc. But if you want to have those sorts of solutions for data integration, for reasoning, that also have a geospatial context to them, then you need some way to represent and query about the geographic information in those applications. So we have here a couple of example questions. Which hospitals within 20 miles have appropriate treatment centers for my patient? In order to answer that question, we need to be able to reason about what it means for the hospital to have an appropriate treatment center for the patient. So that would be information about the patient's condition, information about what facilities the hospital has. But we also need to be able to do the spatial reasoning part of that, of having those hospitals' locations and where they are. Same for the second query. What airports within 50 miles of a mission objective can support a C5? We need both the semantic reasoning and the geospatial reasoning in order to be able to answer this question. Secondly, if we're going to have data stores that can support these kind of queries, then they're going to need to be able to efficiently support geospatial reasoning. And if they're going to do that, we know from experience with relational databases that that's going to mean some sort of spatial indexing. Now, since triple stores in general don't have any specific indexing requirements for any particular vocabularies, by creating a common vocabulary for GeoSparkle, we allow triple stores to support that vocabulary and then index on it in a reasonable way. On to the next slide. On slide 4, what we wanted with GeoSparkle is to give a very, very minimal RDF / OWL / Sparkle vocabulary for storage and query of geospatial information. We want you to be able to take this as a core piece of an ontology and build your domain around it. The only classes in this are geometries and features, and the superclass of them, which is simply a spatial thing. We have the relationships between the geometries and features. And the general idea is that your domain classes would be subclasses of feature. As a result of this, triple store implementations, and we'll talk more about those in a little bit, can spatially index information that comes in the GeoSparkle vocabulary and perform spatial reasoning on it. In terms of use cases, we tried to make it so that GeoSparkle is simple enough for linked open data and for non-geography professionals, but also robust enough to be used for serious geospatial data. So institutions like the USGS can publish their data in GeoSparkle and have it interoperate. If we're going to have this work on the semantic web, then we need to be able to cover this whole range of use cases so that when people try to do data integration applications, you can still reason between people's simple points of interest ontologies and someone's very complicated hydrography use case. On to slide 5. Super, super briefly, Sparkle is a W3C recommendation for querying RDF and OWL. I don't have time to really walk through too much of Sparkle here. We're showing an example Sparkle query. And the basic idea is you have prefixes like many RDF-related specifications, and then you can execute a couple of different kinds of queries, the most basic one being a select query, and you put in that query a graph pattern that you are attempting to match from the underlying triple store. That syntax in the graph pattern is based on the turtle serialization of RDF, which we'll use a little bit more of later when I show you the example data. But in Sparkle, the turtle can have variables in it, like the variable X here. So this query that we're looking at asks for things and their titles where the thing's price is less than 30. So you can imagine this being a book query to Amazon. Show me books and give me their titles where their price is less than 30. On to slide 6. The structure of GeoSparkle is it uses W3C's Sparkle extensibility framework. So it's an extension to Sparkle in that sense, though it doesn't require any particular change to parsing of Sparkle in order to be supported, just a sort of change of how the properties are interpreted. There's a shared vocabulary, which is represented in OWL and RDF, either one that you would like to use. It includes the feature model and a geometry model. And it has this minimal set of classes and properties surrounding the triple pattern. It contains a set of data types based on text-based geometry serializations. Right now, there are two included in GeoSparkle. Well-known text, which is slightly augmented for supporting different coordinate reference systems within a well-known text literal, and GML. This allows you to add geometries expressed in well-known text or GML into your RDF literals. There are different conformance classes within the specification for each of the serializations. meaning the triple store that claims to support GeoSparkle does not need to support both WKT and GML, but it can support both, and in practice, so far, the systems seem to be implementing both, which is good for users. There's also a set of shared filter functions within the specification, and this allows the comparison of geometries and some transformations between the geometries, and I'll talk a little bit more about those in detail later. Finally, one thing that I won't really get to today, there are query rewrite rules for spatial relations between features, both explicit triples and implicit geometry. This is more of an advanced topic in GeoSparkle right now, so I won't touch on that much today. On to slide 7. Usually when I talk about GeoSparkle, someone inevitably asks, well, why do I need this when there's already so much data in the W3C Geo specification, which, if you're not familiar with it, is a very, very, very simple specification for attaching latitudes and longitudes in the WGS 84 reference system to things on the semantic web. While W3C Geo is great for simple cases, it only supports point geometries, it only supports the one coordinate reference system, and there's no way to express spatial relationships within that. So going back to what I said before about supporting the whole range of use cases from simple to complex, we need something a little bit more complex like GeoSparkle in order to represent those cases. If you do have W3C data in W3C Geo format data, or you need to use someone's W3C Geo format data with your GeoSparkle, it's not a problem. All you need to do is execute one simple Sparkle query, and you can effectively convert W3C Geo data into GeoSparkle information. There's a reference there if you want to see how to do that. So W3C Geo is very simple and very useful, but GeoSparkle offers significantly more functionality. On to slide 8. This is a simple diagram here to show how we conceptualize the use of GeoSparkle in some application. The innermost circle is the GeoSparkle core, which has both ways to represent geometries and features, and the topology relationships between them. We expect that that is only going to be one component in any given domain ontology. So around that GeoSparkle core, for some given domain, we're going to end up attaching domain classes. We want those, and those classes would be anything that has some sort of geographical properties to it. And those can become features. And of course, around that, you still have all of the other things in your domain that don't necessarily have anything to do with geography, but are probably still related to those geographical things. So the slide is here to just emphasize the point that this is intended to be a good foundation for your geospatial ontologies and allow reasoning between them. On slide 9, we show the parts of GeoSparkle and where they're used. There are really two main parts in this view. One is the ontology itself, which includes classes for features, geometries, and literals for geometry descriptions. And where you would be using these terms is within your domain ontology, obviously, because you are going to be attaching to GeoSparkle, as we'll see momentarily, with your ontology, and with your instance data, because the instance data will need to use these terms when describing itself. Then there's a second set of terms, which are the query terms. There are topological relational properties. There are transformational properties, and I'll talk about both of those. And where you use those is within your Sparkle queries to get the data back out in ways that is useful, ways that are useful. On slide 10, I'm showing what I mean here when I say that these classes are extended. The top half of the chart is the classes that are in GeoSparkle. There are only three. There are three main classes, that is. There's the geospatial object, which includes both features and geometries. There's a feature, and you can think of the feature as any actual entity that has that might exist in a place on Earth. So a building is a feature, or a school is a feature, or a park is a feature. And a geometry is a feature's representation of where it is on Earth. So a geometry might be a point with a specific latitude and longitude. It might be a polygon that has a series of latitudes and longitudes that define where it is. And features relate to geometries with the has geometry property. Below that, we have an example of some specific domain classes. So if let's say we were defining a points of interest ontology, and in our domain we want to talk about parks and cities and monuments, all we need to do to connect these things to GeoSparkle is make the things that are features subclasses of the feature class. And since L and RDF support multiple inheritance, that's not necessarily a problem with other superclasses that those might be subclasses of. On to slide 11, there are a number of data type properties for geogeometry, because the geometry is where all of the quantitative spatial information is stored for reasoning. There are various attributes of the dimensions, whether or not the geometry is simple, is empty, is 3D, but highlighted are the very key ones, which are either as well-known text or as GML, and these are the properties which link to the geometry serializations, which is how the geometry is actually defined. The slide here shows that you're guaranteed only one of these, support for only one of the two well-known texts or GML. But as I mentioned before, so far implementations seem to be doing both, which is great because that gives you that much more interoperability between data representations. On slide 12, this is the first example of the actual serializations that I've been talking about. Again, there are two conformance classes for well-known text and GML. If you're used to GML, your GML simply goes as is into GML literals. If you're used to well-known text, there is one change, which is that in the beginning of a well-known text literal, you can specify the full URI for a coordinate reference, for a spatial reference system identifier. And that is so that different coordinate reference systems can be tucked into a WKT literal. If you don't put a spatial reference system identifier in your well-known text literal, that doesn't mean that you are just putting points on a Cartesian plane. What that means is that you are explicitly using the default CRS, which is CRS84. So make sure that you're aware of that. This is good because it aligns well with the simple use case, as is supported by W3C Geo, etc. On slide 13, I show the topological spatial relations that are available in GeoSparkle. There are three different sets of terminology that you can use to do these, but overall they provide basically the same functionality, and that is to allow querying the relations between the geometries the topological relations between the geometries. That is, whether they overlap, whether they touch each other, whether they're inside one another. And if you are familiar with geographical data, then I'm sure you've done all of these things already. If not, there are easy introductions to them on Wikipedia to see what each of these relationships looks like. On slide 14, there are also a series of transformational filter functions that can be used in your queries, and these are good when you are doing some more complex queries. These are things like intersection and union. So if you need to see whether a point is within the union of two polygon geometries, then here's the function union to do it. There's also buffer, which is generally useful, which allows you to say, to put an area around a particular geometry and check whether something else is within inside that, etc. On slide 15, we have current implementations of GeoSparkle. BBN's Parliament Triple Store that I have worked on is available at parliament.semobcentral.org. It's totally open source. It's based on Jenna and Joseki and has a backend for storing triples that is designed that was designed at BBN. Oracle has an implementation that is forthcoming. It's been suggested that that's going to be in their next release, but no one has officially said that I know of has officially said when that's going to be yet. And recently, the Strabon implementation out of a group in Greece is supporting GeoSparkle as well. So I encourage you to take a look at these if you are interested in trying out GeoSparkle. On slide 16, we show a very simple example points of interest ontology. So we have points of interest, which could be attractions, or they could be services. Attractions are monuments, parks, or museums, and a service is a restaurant. And if you assume that all of the things that are circled in green here are part of my application's domain ontology, then the only thing I need to do to connect that domain ontology to GeoSparkle is that top link there, which says that a point of interest is a subclass of feature. On slide 17, I show the RDF expressed in Turtle that is equivalent to what was on the diagram screen just before that. So you don't need to digest this right now, but it's an example here to go back and look at later if you were going to start making your own ontology. On slide 18, I show just that same RDF data again being inserted into the Parliament Triple Store via the Insert tab. And I'm showing this so that you can see how if you were going to start making this data yourself, you could use Parliament or some other triple store to add this in. On slide 19, there's a map of a small area of Washington, D.C. And there are two geometries highlighted on this. The big polygon geometry that's all shaded blue is a particular park. And the point geometry that's over there on top of the Washington Monument is for the Washington Monument. So this is what the data looks like visually on slide 20. we have the RDF for this data. We can see that there is a point geometry for the Washington Monument and a polygon geometry for the National Mall. And as you can see, the polygon geometry looks significantly more complex because it has a bunch of points in it. On slide 21, we show inserting that data into Parliament through the same interface as before. And then on slide 22, we actually show a query with this. So which monuments are spatially within which parks? And in order to do that, we write our GeoSparkle query down here at the bottom. The parks that are in red are things that are in the GeoSparkle namespace. We ask for M, which is a thing that is a monument, and it has a particular geometry. A P is a thing that is a park, and it also has a geometry. And the geometry of the monument is within the geometry of the park. And if we go on to slide 23, we see the same query in Parliament's query interface. And if we execute that query, we see the results on slide 24, which is, as you would expect, the one monument within the one park. Now, obviously, when you're talking about geospatial applications, we're not necessarily, this is more of a developer type interface than an end user interface. And you may have something map based as the actual front end to your application or some other sort of web based UI. But I just wanted to sort of walk you through the process of creating these RDF things for testing and showing you how GeoSparkle works. On slide 25, this example is obviously super simple. It's just the tip of the iceberg. And I want to stress that the point of GeoSparkle isn't to replicate functionality that already exists in spatial relational databases. It's about adding this geospatial reasoning to other semantic web reasoning to get you even further on your goal, on the path to a real intelligent knowledge base. So when you attach this to your domain, then your domain is going to have an interesting ontology, and that's going to allow you to do interesting queries that have both domain reasoning and geospatial reasoning within them. So we talked about the hospitals within 20 miles of a treatment center before. You can also imagine a data integration application where you say, which hotels with 3-star ratings are within 10 kilometers of at least 3 attractions with 4-star ratings? So many things have geospatial context associated with them that GeoSparkle is intended to really be a piece of a lot of different applications in a lot of different domains. Finally, on slide 26, the point that I would like to leave you with is that if you are going to develop an ontology and your ontology happens to be geospatial, I want you to be aware that this exists now and so that you can use it easily and thus get for free reasoning in various triple stores and not have to reinvent representations for this sort of thing. And that is all for now, and I'm not sure if we are going to take questions now or if that's at the end of the session.
Okay, thank you, Dave. So, Peter, are you there? Usually we do questions at the end, and we still have Leo and Krishna to talk about the wrap-up for the mini-series.
Yes. Krishna, Leo and Krishna's segment is like about 15-20 minutes, so maybe we could do a quick 10-minute Q&A in case people have questions about the earlier presentations or things of interest to discuss at this point. As usual, the if you have if you want to make a remark or you have a question, what you want to do now is to click on the hand button, which is at the lower right corner of your chat window, and that will cue you up, and either Nancy or Mike mainly will call upon the speakers that are queued up. Okay. So.
Thanks, let's see. The first hand up I saw was Leo.
Yes, thanks, Mike. Actually, I expressed the question in chat, too, to Dave about the region connection calculus. So on one of his slides, it did mention Sparkle, the GeoSparkle supported at least some of the axioms for the region connection calculus, and these are things like overlap and proper part and so forth. And he's answered, but perhaps Dave, you want to say something via voice about the question?
Yeah, sure. That'll let me elaborate a little bit more. So there are two types of reasoning that the GeoSparkle specification supports. There is quantitative reasoning, which is to say if you have explicit geometries for all of your features, like the ones that I showed, where we ground them in points and polygons, then you can reason about those RCC properties, like within, by actually checking to see if that point is within that polygon or not. The second type of reasoning is qualitative reasoning, where you don't necessarily know the explicit geometries for each of the features, but you may know that geometry A is within geometry B, and geometry B is within geometry C, which from RCC we would know that geometry A is within geometry C because within is transitive. The current implementations don't do qualitative reasoning. There's been a fair amount of work in making an OWL form of axioms that support RCC. So you could use the GeoSparkle vocabulary and add those axioms to your knowledge base and do qualitative reasoning about those things. But it's a lot more limited than doing the quantitative reasoning, obviously. So that wasn't the focus of my talk.
So, Dave, I thought at one point those axioms actually were part of the standard. Am I remembering incorrectly, or did that just get dropped at some point?
I think you may be remembering incorrectly. There's a set of axioms that's, if I'm remembering correctly, the set of axioms that's within the spec is for rewriting feature-to-feature relations into geometry-to-geometry ones.
I see. Let's see. Dahlia, you had a question as well? You may need to do star 7. Dahlia, we're not hearing you. Yeah.
Okay, I just got the unmuted message. Thanks a lot. My question has to do with the person creating ontologies and related semantic technology for earth sciences, the kind of the labor force. It seems to me that, as Peter once mentioned, you can't really expect earth scientists to become full-time ontologists. And Conversely, ontologists won't be tracking, you know, the scientific concepts in earth science. So it seems to me that very often in these laboratories, although earth scientists may have the luxury of a computer programmer on their project or an ontologist, that would be even more rare, but very often their technical support comes from students, and usually students in their own domain. And those students increasingly can program and do have computer science skills, but, you know, they're kind of filling a gray area between here. And so I guess I'd like to ask the speakers if, you know, what they think about that, that gray area. Do you think that conceivably maybe in the future there may be something analogous to a GIS specialist who might become become more established in, or do you have any other ideas about how these technologies can be applied for earth sciences?
Dolly, I can talk a little bit about not specifically earth sciences, but the usual situation with domain experts and ontologists in other domains. So, for example, intuitively, of course, it's much easier to teach a domain expert, let's say an earth scientist or somebody who has a specialized scientific or engineering background, about logic and ontology than it is to really teach a ontologist about the specific detail of the domain knowledge that a domain expert has. So it usually takes, you know, 20 years of experience and knowledge and learning to become a expert or to acquire domain expertise. Whereas we think that, you know, knowledge about how to do ontologies and logic, though to be an expert in those realms would require maybe 20 years again, that realistic working knowledge can be acquired in less time than that. So when we have projects that have that are developing ontologies, of course we need domain experts to provide the knowledge. So because we don't really have the time to transfer the knowledge back and forth, we have to work together with the domain experts as an ontologist or ontologist. And that means that if you have students, for example, that those students begin to learn, that they're probably focused on the domain, but they begin to learn ontology and logic to assist them in transferring that knowledge of the domain into an ontology. So for earth sciences in particular, you know, I'll let others, you know, address that topic, but it does require typically, you know, close interaction between domain experts and ontologists for at least the duration of the core of the project.
Thank you. Arthur, I see you've published a couple questions in the chat room. Do you want to ask those, the speakers? Arthur Small, you may do star 7. We're not hearing you. Okay, let's see. Oh, he's having my... why don't we go ahead? Scott Hills also has a question.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. That was the second attempt. Okay, I'm going to actually, I typed in a question, so rather than flounder around with it verbally, I thought I'd lay it out here this way. I'm looking for anyone that might know about, any of the speakers that might know about a standard web service specification that could be used to implement and publish an ontology for consumption by, say, online applications. And I'm thinking of the potential to have a distributed collection of, say, reference ontologies, for example, that might be used by a semantic search engine, which can get a concept and maybe a reference to the or a URL to one of those distributed ontologies or thesauri in this case, right? And then basically access the ontology, asking for, you know, definitions of terms, a bunch of use cases for term expansion, for related concepts, those kinds of use cases through that interface. Anybody know of any standard in that space? Dead silence. Either that or I'm muted again.
No, we can hear you. I could benefit from hearing the very first part of the question again.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Did you need me to repeat the question?
If you could, that would help. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So what I'm trying to do is I have one typed in, which is I try to be concise about it there, but to expand on that that question in the chat room, I'm interested in knowing whether anybody knows about a standard web service specification for publishing ontologies, basically an interface that applications can consume the ontology.
I can answer that. I mean, the standard practice is to just basically post the ontology using a standard web server and doing an HTTP GET on it. So,
The entire ontology then?
Well, that may motivate you to modularize your ontology or something like that. But there are some mechanisms that will. Sometimes you see some ontologies that use slashes rather than hashes at the end. You know, partly that's the way. In that case, you need a little more structure. But like I say, the general thing for even moderate-sized ontologies is basically just to put them, make them HTTP accessible. Obviously you want to make sure that you can do that. That's what actually creates the links in structure.
Okay. Yeah, it looks like I'm getting a bunch of suggestions in the chat room, too, I'll look into. Thanks very much. Maybe the one comment thought I have in response to trying to, basically pull the ontology or even modules of the ontology is if you're trying to do this with, if your application is semantic search and you want to maintain a reference, or I should say you want to exploit a reference that someone else is maintaining, then you're going to constantly pulling that thing. And there are some thesauri that I know about that it would be nice to have professional societies publish for this purpose. There are hundreds of thousands of terms in them. And you really don't want to pull that kind of thing, or even it would be difficult to imagine how to modularize it to know how to exploit it for any arbitrary term expansion, for example.
Right. Right.
So, okay. Well, thank you very much for the answers.
Oh, just out of curiosity, are you Scott Hills or Arthur Small?
This is Scott Hills. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Then it's Peter Yim. I referred the speaker to the OR initiative. Then it should have been to you, Scott, not Arthur.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Peter. Thank you.
Okay, let's see. How are we doing on time? Do we want to do a couple more questions now, or should we?
We probably should close fairly soon. Maybe one last one.
Okay, let's see. So, Arthur, I didn't get to you. You suggested that I ask the questions. Since you're having mic trouble. So, let's see. Let me go back a little bit. Find it.
Mike, I'd like to respond to Arthur.
Oh, okay, that would be good. Sure.
Okay, so let's just say that Arthur had an initial question about every database schema has an implicit ontology. Are there any tools that can scan an existing database and extract the implicit ontology and suggest an owl ontology? Yeah, there are some tools. One of the issues, of course, is that a database schema may be pretty sparse and under-specified. So it really doesn't, because it's a structural model, it doesn't express semantics per se. In many cases, what you have to do is, in fact, project a kind of local a local ontology for the database. But there are some tools that we'll look at, for example, XML schema, which you might think of as the equivalent of a schema in a relational database, such as a top RAID put out by Top Quadrant. We've used it to some extent, and of course for XML schema, it's only approximate, so you really have to do a lot of munging after the fact, but at least it gets you perhaps the core of what you need.
So one thing I would add is there's a pair of recent recommendations from the W3C RDB to RDF working group, one called R2RML and the other called the direct mapping, that provide essentially standard mechanisms for exposing relational databases as semantic web content. And yeah, there have long been tools like D2RQ. So, you know, a significant fraction of the linked data cloud, you know, is actually essentially dynamically accessing relational databases to return triples.
Good. Thanks, Mike.
Okay.
Mike, I guess the community would definitely appreciate your capturing those answers onto the chat.
Yeah. Okay. Nancy, so back to you for the last session.
Okay, Leo and Krishna are going to do a wrap-up of the series that we held this fall.
I'll bring up the slides.
Krishna, I'll let you go ahead and talk to the slides if you wish.
Leo, can you hear me?
Yes, yes. We can hear you.
Yeah, okay. I just opened up slide number one.
The server is on slide number one, too. Yeah, everyone is looking at that now.
Everybody's on slide one now. So, Leo, jump in anytime you want, but this is just going to take a few minutes. It's basically to make sure we all understand why this mini-series was created. The most important thing out of this mini-series was to bring together communities, earth science and ontology semantics community together, and I think we've been very, very successful in that activity. Slide two is what were the objectives of the mini-series. This is all online, and you can read it yourself. But the key thing that from a science perspective, this is the interaction that this mini-series promoted, was that we need to have technologies that enable us to share data, enable us to discover data of interest, even if we don't know all the vocabulary for a given domain, and enable integration, fusion, and modeling capabilities. This is what the science community is wanting. And I think somewhere in this dialogue, we have to develop partnerships with teams of people to enable some of these things to take place in and help EarthCube in the process. So just a historical recap. We have had five sessions. Many of the people have participated in all of them. And I would especially like to thank Peter for convening this and making it run so smoothly. And these are on slide four now. I just put down the list of all the speakers just as an acknowledgement that people did provide time and effort to make this mini-series work, and I personally think it's worked very well. And in the next few slides, what I've done is from the abstract submitted by the speakers, I've highlighted what I think are key topics that are worthy of collaborative activities as we move forward. The science community can share what it knows about domain, and what Leo was saying earlier, the ontology semantics community can share its knowledge with us. So, you know, we need to take care of legacy data. How do we do that? It's a very important thing. We need to work together in making semantic web technologies transparent for a user. So the interfaces have to be very, very science-oriented. Search terms, controlled vocabulary. I think those are great ideas, but like someone just mentioned a few minutes ago, we got tens and tens of thousands of terms. How can a non-expert navigate? We need something, you know, to allow people to use the power of ontologies and semantics to discover data even if they don't know the terms. The idea of semantic brokers, all these were topics that were covered in some great detail, and especially like this one on slide 7. You know, we need to preserve the heterogeneity rather than try and solve it every time we try to integrate. Slide 8, people spoke about relationship between ontology schemas, hierarchies, semantic similarities, and concepts that we just heard about on GeoSparkle. We talked about ontology engineers. Can they really identify what we need to know and at what level do we need to work together? In other words, the reference model of consensus. It's a huge, huge challenge, I believe. And then there are existing ontologies. The environment ontology, there are many ontologies in biological sciences, even in geological sciences, putting them together. So they're not disconnected, but putting them together, I would make a strong case. We need a very dynamic semantic collaboratory. So on demand, ontologies could be given to the science community to help them with their research. And eventually, the last few things I wanted to mention, again taken from abstract, that the meanings of earth science terms vary greatly. So we're talking not just one definition, but multiple definitions of a single term. How are we going to be able to handle that? And I took all those highlighted things and I created a little box diagram. As you can see from this, there are many opportunities for continued research through the use of semantics and ontologies to help the geoscience community. Everything from legacy data to semantic collaboratories to process and service ontologies. And in summary, the mini-series identified the value of semantics in sharing, accessing, discovering data. And I call this as the glue that binds EarthCube Enterprise together. And the need to utilize ontologies and semantics for knowledge management, I call this as the necessary science driver for EarthCube. And the need to collaborate, like what this mini-series has tried to do, is a requirement for the successful implementation of EarthCube. So, in summary, all I can say, folks, is thank you to the presenters, participants, and the organizers. And I also want to make sure, for the record, that everybody knows that comes in later offline, that everything we've spoken and done is available to you and we would appreciate your feedback over time. Thank you.
Thank you, Krishna. This is Leo. I just want to add a comment here that this is really just the beginning. So we hope that people will actually participate more closely in EarthCube, which is one initiative going on with NSF, very collaborative. Most of us are participating entirely without funding just to push the community farther ahead in terms of these technologies. So we hope to have follow-on discussions and collaborations, perhaps in future workshops, and we hope you all can participate.
Thank you once again.
So we finally completed this mini-series successfully in great time, and just almost just in time for the Ontology Summit to begin. And for those on the mailing list, you've probably seen announcements of a pre-launch or community session coming up tomorrow. Those who are involved in organizing, welcome to join the first organizing committee for the Ontology Summit, which in a sense is a mini-series and a bigger series that spans year after year. So we invite everyone in the Earth Science community to engage in that activity. Thanks, everyone.
Yes. Peter, could you post a link to that on the chat site, please?
Sure. Yes, I would be glad to. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Great mini-series. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
Bye, everyone.